This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2017, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 4.
Well, I'm going to try to rob the clock just a little bit. There may be one or two other people coming, but I have a lot of things to say and not a lot of time to say it. I tend to be the type of speaker that does a little bit of the fire hose approach. You can't drink it all, but you'll get a lot. So hopefully you can find this useful. And since this is recorded, if you find it useful and you only got about a quarter of it, well, then you can go get the recording and then you can get the other, you know, one third at a time over time. So on the handout, I have kind of just explain a few things about it. I try to put some extra resources on the handout, so I'll be referring later on to some of the examples that I'm giving. I tried to put some of the heaviest information actually there on your handout, so you're not having to try to fill all this information in. I have a step-by-step process that I'm going to be giving, and that's toward the end of your handout, so that you can take that home and use that as a guide. So a lot of you may know who I am. I'm the dyslexia guy. Now this isn't about dyslexia. I think probably this is the only one. Does anyone else need a handout real quick? We have one over here. But I won't be talking about dyslexia this time around. So this is a little bit kind of branching out for me. A little bit of a clickbait title, although if I'd really wanted to get clickbait, I'd have said something like, how to reach 95% of your class using this one weird trick. Or maybe teachers hate him, you know, this grad student discovered, you know, something like that. So I didn't really want to go too far afield, but I also really am not trying to overpromise here. I'm going to explain where that 95% figure comes from, a little bit of the rationale here, but you really can reach the majority of your class by changing some of what you do, some of your mindsets. The basis of this talk, or the seed that this talk was grown out of, has been my last year or so in grad school. I taught for 7 years, quit teaching, and went to a grad school to get my master's in education. And about the first probably 6 or 8 weeks, I kept coming home from class and saying to my wife, I wish I'd have known this. I wish so badly. In the 7 years of teaching, I had no idea this was even a thing. This would have changed everything. And in a lot of cases, it wasn't this super complicated thing. It was just a change in the way that I thought, a change in the way that I viewed things. And so I've developed this to share with you some of the things that I've learned that I just think everybody ought to know and be able to take into their classrooms and use. Now, I know there's probably a number of new teachers here, and I want to caution you here at the beginning. This may seem really overwhelming. I'm not expecting anybody is going to take all this stuff and immediately go and do it in your classroom. Classrooms are kind of like steering a big ship. It takes a long time to make significant course adjustments. But, you know, it's really helpful to make those course adjustments. We have an idea which direction we'd like to start heading. It's a little bit, this differentiation thing, it's a little bit like making flour gravy. You know, if you take a whole cup of flour and you dump it in a skillet, you're going to have a mess. The fire alarm's going to go off. It's going to be awful. You add a little bit at a time. You stir it. You add some more and you stir it. And that's kind of what I want you to do with these ideas that you're going to get today. Take them back to your classroom and just add a little bit here. Take an idea that you got and stir it in. And maybe a couple weeks later, a couple months later, add something else. And after a while, you'll have some differentiation gravy, I guess. So whatever you want to call that. So here's some of the big ideas we're going to be talking about. I'm not going to define them all for you here, but I do want to focus on this one, multidisciplinary project, because I'm going to say that a lot, and that really sounds like a big term. You may not know what that is. Multidisciplinary means it's dealing with different subjects at the same time. So for instance, you may be doing something like building a scale model of the arc. Okay, well, that would be dealing with math because you're doing all the different calculations, plus you're dealing with biblical history because, you know, they're actually studying the Bible, the primary text, and then they're applying it in different ways. So there's a number of different things. I mean, that could actually be, you know, literature and math and history that are all together in that project. So a multidisciplinary project is a project that something the students are making or building or doing or writing or something over a period of time that is involving different subjects coming together. Multidisciplinary projects are terrifically valuable because they help students to understand that knowledge is not a bunch of discrete domains. So here we have math class, here we have science class, here we have history class, and never the twain shall meet. No, we realize history class and math class connect. History class and science class, wow, that connects. You know, I think one terrific idea, you want to talk about a long-term multidisciplinary project, and I would love to do this or talk somebody into doing it, is have a year of science class, maybe at the lower high school level, maybe upper middle school, where you mix your history and your science together so that you start with the simple tools that the ancient astronomers would have used, you know, a stick in the dirt. And then as time progresses, you start adding new technologies, you know, and you do solar observations, you know, and trace both the historical development of astronomy as well as the scientific discoveries that drove astronomy, and the students doing those observations themselves over the course of the year. And maybe about the middle of the year, you reduplicate, you know, Galileo's discovery. Can you imagine what that was like when he finally looks up and he sees the planets that are orbiting Jupiter and so on, and you really connect these subjects and you see how all this connects. So why don't you go ahead and do that and see how, let me know how that works out for you, because I think that would be great. So that is what I'm talking about when I say multidisciplinary project. It's something that brings together various subjects into one project and shows how they work together. And that's a big thing that I'm going to be talking about today as an idea to implement in your classroom. So a lot of this today, I'm using a verse out of Peter where he talks about I've written this to stir up your pure minds. So that's what I'd like to do today. I want to stir up your minds in thinking, here's some ideas, here's some things we can do and take into my classroom and implement that is going to make a big difference. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about theory. Because theory is about the ideas about things. And then we're going to move from theory to practice, because theory is nothing without some way to put wheels on it and go somewhere with it. But I want you to be cautious when I'm talking about practice, because I'm not saying that this practice is a prescription that you need to take and use in this way. Teaching is a holistic endeavor. Every single person here has a different personality. They have different likes. They have different dislikes. They have classrooms that have different makeups. They have communities that have different cultures, different ideas, different things that they think are important, different things they think aren't important. And so for you to take my plan and try to say, oh, it's got to be this way. I heard this at Faith Builders, and you know that must be true. So we have to do it this way. I don't want you to do that. I want you to look at my practice as the practices that I prescribe as saying, here's a way that this theory could work out. This is what it looks like when it works out in real life. So I could take this practice and then I could tweak it or modify it or use it as a jumping off point to develop my own practices that are underpinned by the theories that I've learned here. So I'm cautioning you here, this is not a magic pill. This is not something that, wow, take this back as a whole thing and plop, put it in your classroom and poof, you're going to, you know, have this dramatic change and all this stuff is going to happen overnight. Okay, that's not going to happen. But these ideas are where a lot of these things start. So, and another thing, if you're a new teacher here and you hear all this information, please don't become overwhelmed or discouraged, okay? It takes a while to bring some of these practices in. So maybe just pick one or two things that you'd like to try and you'd like to do, and then build on that from there. Okay, so let's start out by talking about theory. And I want to say this first off. Curriculum is vastly overrated. Curriculum is massively overrated. We think it's about, you know, it's about curriculum. We hear this school's doing a little bit better, and the students over there, boy, they really like science. Well, what kind of curriculum do you use over there? They like science, you know, because I wish my students would like science. Maybe if we use that curriculum, they would like science too. We're putting way too much emphasis on what curriculum is being used. Now, different curricula have different strengths and weaknesses. There are some curricula that are indeed better than other curricula. But that's not the most important thing. If we will change our mindsets and our ideas, we don't change the curriculum, but we change the way we think. that will make a much bigger impact in our classroom and our educational practices than changing the books the students are reading things out of. Let me kind of illustrate this point. How many people know who this guy is in his picture? All right, so a few people follow Olympic sports at least somewhat. This is Michael Phelps. If you don't recognize the fella, you might recognize the name. For those of you that don't even recognize the name, Michael Phelps is an amazing character. He is an Olympic, or was, he's retired now, but he was an Olympic swimmer, an incredible athlete. I mean, this fella is a paragon of training and dedication. Spends 6 hours a day in the water when he's training. Swimming, doing laps, swimming, continuing to push himself, holds the world record. His swimming rate at his peak, he swims 6 miles an hour, and that doesn't sound really fast. But when you're talking about swimming, that is moving. I mean, this man is absolutely amazing. He's won 28 gold medals. That's the most gold medals anybody's won. It's almost 30 more than I personally have won. So, you know, I mean, that's a lot. You know, one fellow was saying, you know, people ask the question sometimes. They're like, hey, if you could go to a desert island, you could only take three things with you, what would you take? And one fellow, I said, I know exactly what I would take. He said, number one, I'd take Michael Phelps. Number two, I'd take a saddle. And number three, I'd take a stick with a gold medal tied on the end. You know, and solve that problem right there. You know, and this is the kind of person that Michael Phelps is. I think it's safe to know this guy knows a few things about swimming. You know, so imagine you were getting into competitive swimming. You know, you're excited about this. You've watched him in the news. You're like, wow, I'd like to do this. You know, swimming is my passion. I'm going to learn about this. And you have an opportunity to talk to the number one swimmer in the world, Michael Phelps. You have an opportunity to sit down with him and ask him a few questions about what he's doing. And you say, Mr. Phelps, you know, I've heard that you know, you're an incredible swimmer. I've followed your achievements. I mean, what you have done is amazing. You have set records. You have broken records. You've then turned around and broken a record that you set the previous year. So I'm just curious, Mr. Phelps, what brand of swimming trunks do you wear? You know, because I'm sure that's really the deciding factor between you winning the Olympics and you just swimming around your swimming pool at home, right? Well, of course not. Now, do swimming trunks make a difference? Yes. Are swimming trunks an element of his success? Yeah, probably. I doubt, you know, he's driving to the Olympic Games and he says, hey, we got to swing by Walmart. I need to pick up a set of trunks for the Games. You know, of course not. He's chosen all of his equipment and everything about him. He's chosen for success. But that's because he's a top performer in a field where 0.2 seconds is the difference between winning and losing. So yeah, probably at that level, the trunks you're wearing is going to make a big difference. You know, the trunks he wears, yeah, I mean, he wears top-end trunks. I mean, he wears trunks that cost $300, and that doesn't even include the outboard motor. Yeah, so, you know, obviously the trunks he's wearing are really, really part of, you know, important to him and so on. But if you're starting out, is that the most important thing to worry about? What trunks am I going to wear? Because that's really going to make... No. You might ask him, what are some things that you do that other swimmers might think are weird that really make a difference for you when you jump into the pool? One thing that he does that a lot of swimmers don't do is he wears his... Most swim caps come down over the swimmer's ears. He wears his where at least one of his ears is uncovered. And that's because as he's swimming, he's got his ear tuned to the roar of the crowd. And he's feeding off that excitement and exhilaration of the crowd that's cheering him on. It's a psychological edge it gives him. And as a new swimmer, you'd probably find that a lot more valuable than what brand of trunks he's wearing. So that's kind of an analogy of curriculum. When you're a top performing teacher and you really understand your game, you really understand what you're doing, you may discover, you know, switching curriculum could really make a difference for me because this curriculum has these features that really match what I'm doing psychologically, philosophically in the classroom. But when you're just starting out and you're learning the fundamentals, focusing on a curriculum switch is a misplaced focus. You're overrating the importance of the curriculum. So let's talk about some ideas, some of these really seriously revolutionary ideas that change the way that you think about teaching. I'm going to talk about statistics in the classroom. All right. Now, I'm going to assume here that you have basically very little information about what statistics is. So a big part of statistics, this is called normal distribution. That was one of the big ideas I talked about at the beginning. Let's imagine that I said, all right, everybody get out of your chairs. We're going to go back out to the field out there, and we're going to run a race. Everybody goes out there. One, two, three, go. And everybody runs. You know, we're going to run 100 yards or whatever. Now, let's suppose then somebody could get up in an airplane and look down out of the window and watch the group of us running across the field. This is what you would see. You'd see a very few people up here in the front. You'd see a few people here in the back, and then you see a whole bunch of people right there in the middle, right? Pretty much any human activity, it's going to clump down like that. A lot way out in the front, a bunch right in the middle, and a few in the back. Your classroom is no different. Academically speaking, you're going to deal with the same thing. And yeah, it may be skewed a little bit from year to year, but pretty much you can mathematically guarantee this is going to be the breakdown of your classroom. And there's actually fractions that you can go and kind of calculate where your students are at from a statistical perspective. Two-thirds of your class are here right in the middle. Now, this right here is dead center. Very few people are dead average. You know, people are usually a little bit before, a little bit after. But they're in this band of normal. That's actually what normal means. It means they're clustered around the norm, which is that line right there in the middle. Two-thirds of your class, roughly, you have to play with the fractions a little bit, because if you actually look at the statistical fractions, they're very, I mean, the denominators are like three or four numbers long. We don't want to mess with that. So just back of the envelope math, two out of three students in your class is right there at the middle. And that's what the curriculum is written to. It's written to reach the students that are right there in the middle. Now, 1/7 of your students are a little bit above average. And I'm saying a little bit above average. They're gifted, so they're not... But they're not Albert Einstein. They're not Elon Musk or anybody like that. They're a little bit better. You know, they're leading the pack. They're not ready to skip a grade. They're not ready to write a thesis on quantum physics or something. But they catch on faster than the average student. You know, this student, you have to say it 6 times before it sinks in. But this student over here, you got to say it 2 times and he gets it. So now he's frustrated because you said it 3 times more than he needed to hear it, you know. So you got to worry about these fellows. Now back here, these guys are trailing the pack. Where the ones in the middle need 6 or 8 repetitions, they need 10 or 12. So once again, you know, you're going to have to take that into account. So you've got 3 basic groups in your classroom. We're going to come back to this idea later on. But this is the statistical breakdown of your classroom. Now, let's do this as a pie graph. And I use the number 21 to kind of give you an idea. It's a nice kind of a, it's not a round number, but for our purposes it is. So this big yellow section is the 2/3 of your classroom. This is the big clump right there in the middle. You've got 3 and 21. If you have 21 students, 3 of those are going to be on the back end. 3 of those are going to be on the front end. 14 of them are going to be in the middle. And then out of those 21, you're going to have this little segment that you're going to have somebody who's an outlier. You will encounter outliers. You will encounter students that are either very advanced or very not advanced. Okay? This class is not about reaching those students. This class is about reaching this. This is 95% of your class right here. That's where that 95% figure comes from. And sometimes as a teacher, and I'm not saying you figure this out on week 1 because that's a bad idea, but eventually as you teach for a while, you're going to realize here's a student that I thought was in this section that's trailing in the rear, but they're actually one of the 5%. The mainstream classroom and what I'm doing, I'm not going to be able to reach that student. That's okay. It's far better to realize that and realize, let's just make some drastic changes to what we're doing than to frustrate yourself, frustrate the student, frustrate mom and dad, frustrate everybody because you keep trying to get the student to do something that they actually are physically or mentally incapable of doing. So be aware of that. That's 1 in 21. That's, I mean, you know, this isn't a statistically random sample, you know. But, you know, in a group of people this size, that 1 in 21 is in here somewhere, you know. Theoretically, like I said, this isn't actually a random sample because we're self-selected. But that's something to think about. This is not incredibly rare. This isn't 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 5,000. This is going to be in your community. Now, he could also be really advanced. It could be a student that's really advanced and is needing to skip a grade or something like that. Once in a while, you'll have that. So, you know, so then it's 1 in 42 is actually going to be statistically the one that's guaranteed to be low. But even 1 in 42 is, you're going to encounter it as a teacher. You teach for very long, you're going to encounter that student. What are you going to do? Well, hopefully you're going to act with understanding. Hopefully you're going to be willing to make some significant modifications to help that student. And I wished I'd have known that, because I had situations that I encountered in teaching that I look back and I realize, you know what? There just was enough struggle there that there's some concepts that just aren't going to get across like I wish they would. And I need to walk away from that and say, okay, this is actually something that's too hard for you. So let's do something else. Let's change gears. So that's the basis of a lot of what we're talking about. That's one of the big theories that underpins what we're talking about, is the statistical theory in a classroom. And as far as I'm concerned, this idea alone was just about worth the admission to grad school for me, because it was absolutely revolutionary in the way that I viewed teaching, is understanding this, that you're going to encounter this in your class. This breakdown is going to happen in your class. Prepare yourself for it. Think about, this will be what you encounter. Then I want to talk about a skills-based mindset. This is the second big theory that I want to talk about. There's a fellow that I follow online. One of his big lines is, skills pay the bills. Everything in life should be about developing skills, getting good at stuff. And obviously, that should be the main emphasis here in education, is getting good at stuff. They're getting good at math. They're getting good. And I want to draw a very clear line of distinction between skill-based subjects and content-based subjects. And I'd like you to think this morning as I'm talking that primarily I am focusing on skill-based subjects. And there's a reason for that, and that's because content-based subjects are impossible to master. You can't master content-based subjects. Because think about it. History. Can you master history? Well, no, there's so many things. Can you know about the Napoleonic era and, you know, the Russian culture and, you know, Uzbekistan and what their socioeconomic policy was in the 1520s or what? No, of course not. You know, I have no idea. I don't even know if Uzbekistan was around in the 1520s, because that's outside of it. But that's within that content subject. You know, even if it's a really well-known subject, like World War II or the Civil War, well, there's all these other things that you can continually discover new things that were going on you had no idea. There's no way to become an expert in a content-based subject that you say, yeah, I definitely know history. Where math is a different story. You can master third-grade level math. You can throw any third-grade level math problem at me, and I can solve it, because I have mastered that skill. And so I want to draw a distinction, and I want you to think. Skills-based subjects are one side of it, and then we're going to base a lot of our projects that I'm talking about on the content-based subjects, because content is something that students can really branch out. And you can have 25 students, and they're all branching out in a different area of the content. You're not going to do that in math. You're not going to have, well, this student, he really likes fractions, so he's going to work on fractions. This one's going to work on decimals. This one's going to work on, you know, place value. The skills all run together. But, you know, if you had students in your class that you were able to work, they were able to work on individualized projects, one could be working on the cotton gin and its effects in the South, and somebody over here could be working on a system of slavery in the U.S. in the 1830s, and this one over here can be talking about how paddle wheelers' invention, Robert Fulton's things, affected trade on the Mississippi. And they're all in the same area of history, but each student is digging into and differentiating, which is the idea of taking different paths within a subject. So we forget this a lot of times, that education is about learning skills. And we get into this factory mindset. I'm the foreman of a factory, and what we produce at this factory is filled in blanks. So you are my workers, and you come here and you sit in your workstations and you fill in blanks. And when you reach your quota of blanks that have been filled in today, then you can go home, or you can go and do something fun because you've met your quota for the day. And that's the mindset we have too often in teaching. And I say, as a kind of embarrassed about it, but that was my mindset in teaching. It was easy to slip into, well, how do we know an education is happening? Well, the blanks are getting filled in, so we know that things must be happening. We know they must be learning something, right? Because they got all the blanks filled in. Well, not necessarily. You know, and then we have a student miss 3 days of school, and then so they have to catch up, and it means they have to fill in all those blanks for the day they missed. We're forgetting that it's about learning the skills, and filling in the blanks is a method to learning the skills, and it's also a way of proving or demonstrating that you indeed have learned the skills. Now, I want to clarify something. It's okay to expect your students to do some catch-up work. I mean, if you just said, hey, just demonstrate to me that you know the skills, you would have some students that every time they sneezed in the morning getting ready for school, they're going to quit because they're advanced enough. They know they can sit down, read the lesson, do 3 problems to demonstrate it, and boy, they just had a day off. They had a vacation day as a sick day. You're going to have students that do that. Okay, so there are some other reasons why you might require some makeup to kind of put some pressure. You don't want to miss too much school because there is a price to pay for it. But we tend to be thinking too backward in our approach to what learning and education is. And one way we do this, we get stuck with students walking them through problems. So, you know, you'll have a situation like this. Maybe they're doing fractions and are adding the fractions together, you know, and they don't know how to do it. You know, it's common denominator. So we have to find a common denominator, then we add the fractions together. And a student has a page of 22 of these to do because it's review, you know. And he says, oh, I know how to do this. Okay, all right, so what do we do first? I'll remember. Okay, all right, so here's what we're going to do. We have to first check and see if the bottom number is the same, right? The denominator, that's what that's called. Remember that? Oh, yeah, that's right. So we have to check and see if that denominator is the same. Okay, is the denominator the same? Yeah, it's the same. Okay, so we can add them together. So, okay. No, remember, you don't add the denominators together. You only ever add the numerators together. Oh, that's right, so they add it. You know, okay, so now we have to look, right? Is the top number, the numerator, is that number bigger than the denominator? Yeah, it is. Okay, so what do we have to do? Well, I don't remember. Okay, so remember we have to divide the numerator by the denominator, and then that's going to give us a mixed number. We're going to write the remainder as a fraction. Oh, that's right. You know, so they do it. They fill it in. Okay, so finally we're finished with the first problem. Okay, so let's do the next one now. We walked you through the steps. We used to do the next one. I don't remember what to do. Okay, so we remember what we do. We look at the bottom numbers are the same. Oh, good. So that means we could just add straight away. You know, and you go on, and then all of a sudden we run into one where the denominators are different. So now you got to explain the whole process of finding the common denominator, multiplying, and all those good things that you have to do. And eventually, after 15 or 20 minutes of walking them through every single problem on a page, the blanks are all filled in. Do they know how to add fractions and a whole common denominator? No. But you as a teacher walk away with a sigh of relief because those blanks are filled in, so I did my job today. I mean, maybe nobody else has ever been in that situation as a teacher, but I did that a lot. It's such an easy trap to fall into. You know, so maybe what we can do is we can try to short circuit that, and we say, well, I'm going to make you a list of steps, and you're going to walk through the steps, and you're going to follow the steps. And a problem is, at the end of the time, they still don't really know how to add fractions together. They just know how to follow the series of steps. They didn't really actually learn a skill. This can actually be kind of a sneaky way of still falling into that mindset. You know how to tell if a student actually knows it? When you start trying to introduce doubt into their minds. You like push them a little bit. Are you sure? And they're like, well, I don't know. They don't know then. Okay, let me illustrate. A number of years ago when I was here at Faith Builders, we were in a hotel there in Meadville. So we'd have to drive, 15, 20 minutes over here for the sessions each day. And I am not really somebody who's got great directional confusion. I have directional confusion. I don't have a strong sense of direction. It's my dyslexia talk creeping in. I do not have a strong sense of direction. It's a good thing I wasn't Columbus. You know, he would have discovered the East Indies, you know, because there would have been a wrong turn somewhere. Okay, so it's not really my strong point. So it takes me a while to find my way around. Now, I don't believe in GPS for that reason, because if you follow a GPS, you're never really sure where you're going. You never really know the direction you're headed. You know, and so what happens then is, you know, I decided I'm sick of following this GPS, especially because ours would lose connection every now and again, and then you really don't know where you are. You know, I hope this thing comes on because I really think my turn's coming up. So let's suppose that, so eventually I started trying to drive without it more and more because that's really how you learn. But if I'd have come up to the intersection and my wife would have said to me, are you sure this is where we turn? I think so. Actually, you know what? Might be the next intersection. You know, then you're out in the woods somewhere. So I didn't actually know. But eventually you get to the point where it sinks in. You know how to get there. Contrast that situation to driving to church on Sunday morning. You know, I come up to the intersection 183. I look both ways. My wife says, do we turn here? She doesn't actually say that, but imagine she did. I'm like, no. We cross the intersection. Are you sure? Look, I know how to get to church. I've driven this so many times, I know exactly how to get to church. It doesn't matter. She could try to talk me out of it. She could try to confuse me. She would try to say, well, isn't Alliance that way? No, it's not. It's over there. I know where we are. I know how to get here. I know what's going on. I really know how to get there. That's where your students need to be at. Are you sure you put the two up here? Yeah, that's what you do when you carry. You put it up there, okay? So that's not a problem. But if they're like, no, wait, I think I... No, then they don't know how to do it. You don't really know. If you aren't confident, if you can get talked out of it, you don't really know it. Okay? So don't be afraid. You know, sometimes we as teachers, we're afraid to push back because we just want them to fill the blanks in and get this lesson finished, right? And if we start sowing some doubt, then they're not going to know how to do it anymore. And a spoiler alert is, they don't know how to do it anyway. So you as a teacher have to really start drilling down, what do they know how to do? Are we actually developing the skills that they need to learn? So that is something that is big. Changing curriculum isn't going to help if you're not focusing on learning the skills, identifying what skills they don't know and bringing them up. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about changing the way you think. This is a major shift in the way you think. And we've gone off the rails in a major way. I could really go down. I could do a talk on how we've gone off the rails in our mindsets here. But I'm talking about this. So let's talk about some practices that we can implement, some ways that we can put legs on this theory. Number one, assessment is your friend. Assessment needs to be absolutely one of the biggest things that you are focusing on, specifically formative assessment. Now, if you're like me, you had no idea what formative assessment is. I went to grad school and they started talking about formative assessment, and I had no idea what that meant. Fortunately, there were other people in the class who also didn't know, so they were kind enough to tell us what it meant. Formative assessment is assessment that you use to guide your instruction. Okay? So a simple type of formative assessment would be this. If I would just simply say to you, how many of you know what formative assessment is? You know, and three people would raise their hands. Then that would tell me, as an instructor, oh, I better explain to them what formative assessment is, because otherwise the rest of what I say isn't going to make any sense. But if everybody raised their hands, then I would say, oh, I could go to the next point because I don't have to belabor this because everybody here already has heard about formative assessment. They must have been in another class this weekend because I know one of the other people talked about it. So maybe you were in her class, so that's why you know what it is. So now I don't have to worry about it because everybody was already there. So that's what formative assessment is. As a teacher, you need to be doing a lot of that. It can be informal, like asking questions. Hey, how many have heard of this? How many know about that? How many could tell me what to do in this situation? You know, ask, Joe, what about that? Frank, what, you know, and so forth. And then they can tell you and you can start gauging. Another thing you can do is you can do like a pre-quiz. So you have everybody fill out, you know, a worksheet that just shows that they know how to do it. Here's a worksheet of fractions. We're going to be talking about adding fractions this week. And so this is some things that I want to see what your level of ability is. So then you get all those in, you look at them and you say, wow, I have a lot of students that think it's okay to add the denominators together. I better spend some time explaining what fractions are and why we can't add denominators together. So that tells you a starting point for your instruction. You're like, wow, okay, this is obviously something that's missing. And so assessment is something that you have to make part of your classroom if you want to be teaching these skills, if you want to get in the skill-based mindset. Employ lots of formative assessments. And I want to say this, and I'll probably say it like three times, because everybody needs to hear it. Not everything has to be graded. We have this obsession with grading stuff. You don't have to grade everything. Not everything needs a grade on it, okay? We think about skills. Think about another skill, okay? Let's imagine that you're a mom and you're teaching your daughter how to bake. Okay, so obviously, how do you know if your daughter can bake? Well, she can get the recipe, she dumps the stuff in and she stirs it, and she puts it in the oven and bread or cake or whatever comes out and it's edible. Then she knows how to make that thing, right? So she has a skill. Now, you could say, well, this is, you know, you could look at the bread and say, well, this bread tastes a little salty. Maybe you put too much of this in. Or this bread is pretty heavy and bulky. You know, it needs to be more fluffy, so maybe you need more of that. I don't know about baking. I don't know what you need. But I'm using this as an example. So the thing is, you're not going to look at her and say, well, you know, she bakes bread, and this time it's flat, and she bakes bread again, and this time it's salty, and she bakes bread again. But you know, at the end of the week, she bakes a perfect loaf of bread. And she bakes it three or four more times, so you know it wasn't just an accident, because even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while, you know? So you realize she actually can do this consistently. You say, well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you have a C in bread making, because you spent the last 3 weeks making breads that was an F. You had an F on the first bread, you had F on the second bread, you had F on the third bread, and the fourth bread, and the fifth bread. Yeah, you can bake bread now, but your average is still a C. Because, you know, it took you so long to learn it. What? No, the question is, can she bake bread now? If she can bake bread now, that's great. So you don't have to grade every element of the process. You don't have to grade her scooping technique into the bowl or whatever. And we do all this assessment and grading and stuff, and we're losing the emphasis we need to have on, are you learning the skills? Are you demonstrating that you know this? And if you can, that's great. If not, let's do some more work at it. And this is especially true in the elementary to middle school grades. As you get into high school, there's a lot more student-driven things, and so you can grade based on quality of a final product and a big project and stuff. And that can be a lot more useful. But in the younger grades, when you're learning skills, question, do they know the skill or not? How well do they know the skill? How consistently do they know the skill? And that should be your driving emphasis. So yeah, you don't have to grade everything. So, use assessments a lot. Assignments, get rid of busy work. How do you know what busy work is? That's something you do have to have some experience doing, okay? If you're a new teacher here and you hear me say, get rid of busy work, please don't go in your classroom in the first 2 weeks, get real slap happy. Yeah, we talked about that yesterday. You probably definitely don't need that. Draw an X through that page, this page, cross those two out. It's going to take some time as a teacher to be able to gauge, do they actually know the skills or not? How can you tell? But keep in your mind that we have students going to school. In my opinion, a lot of time is getting wasted. And students are getting bored because they're doing the same thing. They're doing things that they learned, and they just have to do it because we have so many blanks that have to be filled in. We're back to that mindset. School is a job. You fill in the blanks. When you get done filling in the blanks, your quote is filled. You go on. Instead of thinking as we are learning skills, we're sharpening what we know. If we've learned this thing, we're going to move on and learn something else. We're continually expanding our base of knowledge. So make that your objective. And we want lifelong learners. We want learners that are self-directed. You're not going to learn that with a factory mindset that we have so much to do, and once we're done, we're done. And the thing is, if you as a teacher start implementing some of this, you may have trouble changing your own mind, but it's likely you're going to have some time changing your students' minds. It's going to take them a while to get used to a skill-based process because they are so used to, in so many cases, they're so used to, I got to get this work done. And that's what it's about. I got to fill these blanks in, you know? And if a class, you know, you spend a little bit extra time explaining something, they get a little frustrated because you're taking time away from them that they need to fill their blanks in. Well, that's a completely wrong concept of what this is about. So be really aware of that. And so you can start realizing, how much does a student need to do? And this student might need 10 reps. This student might need 15 reps or 20 reps of a certain skill to really get it solidified. So you want to be forcing them to demonstrate they can do it. And once a student can consistently demonstrate they know how to do it, then they don't need to do it anymore. as far as from a practice perspective. Then you want to be doing ways of applying it. So it's going back to the bread example. So I'm going to teach you how to make bread. Now that you know how to make bread and you've shown me you know how to make bread, every now and then I'm going to say, hey, we have company this weekend. I'd like you to make 5 loaves of bread. Well, that's actually applying it for a specific reason. You know, I'm not going to say, well, you know, I know you already learned how to make bread, but we have to review bread making. So make 5 loaves today. And then tomorrow you're going to make 5 more loaves. And tomorrow you make 5 more loaves. Well, how about making some cheesecake or something like that? Learning some other skills, branching out. You see what I'm saying? So as a teacher, you've got to focus on figuring out how to move their skills along, remove the busy work, and say, well, the textbook says we got to make 5 loaves of bread today, so let's get at it and get that done, and we can go out and play ball. And just as a side note, you hear a lot of this. When are we going to use this in life? Okay, if you're a teacher and that one annoys you like it annoyed me, I have the best response in the world for you. This is what you say. Brother Iker, when are we going to use this in life? Well, I don't know. Probably about the same time we use volleyball in life, so I reckon we ought to cut out recess, don't you think? Okay, you don't actually believe that. Okay, so that's a good response. You can take that back and use it. So this is about building skills, building ideas. That needs to be the number one objective. And the thing is, anything in life that's valuable requires self-directed learning. Self-directed, you know, you're going to do a workshop here at Faith Builders. You got to come up with your idea. You got to come up with your focus. You got to build this. This isn't something that I sat down and said, well, I have a worksheet to fill out. You know, nobody likes filling out forms. And that's basically what we're having students do. We're having students fill out forms. If people enjoyed filling out forms, we wouldn't be hiring accountants to do our taxes. You know, so this is, it's something that may be valuable to some degree, but there's other ways of doing it. And this is where multidisciplinary projects can come in handy. And let me just show you a couple examples. And I have these websites. These are projects that I created for grad school. This is a unit that I did on Gettysburg. And then Gettysburg's kind of the focus. And then there was like a whole Civil War unit that went around it. And I have, at the top, there's an extended project tab. And these are a number of projects that I recommended that a student could choose from. So what I would do with my class in this case is I would say, okay, we're going to do this unit on Gettysburg for the next several weeks. We're going to be talking about the Civil War era. We're kind of focusing on Gettysburg and then spreading out from there. And each of you is going to be working on a long-term project. So you could choose a game-to-history comparison. So you're going to take a game, because I'm a big board gamer, I'll put a plug for that. But you're going to choose a game from the selection that I have here, and you're going to play it a couple times, then you're going to compare your results of what happens in a game to the actual historical results of what happened. You're going to compare, could this have happened in real life? Or could what happened in real life happen in this game? Is that possible to be simulated under the current rules? You could do a graphic novel. So they're going to do like a little comic book with drawings and stuff. And especially for a student that's good at drawing and bad at writing, you know, they can just do the little word bubbles and stuff. And they could do a little story. So they're going to take Abraham Lincoln writing the Gettysburg Address. And so they could show, you know, draw Abraham Lincoln sitting there writing it and whatever. And they're going to have to read about it. And then they're going to create a project that they're working on. They could do primary source research. So I would provide them with, here's this general's account of what he encountered at Gettysburg. Here's what this textbook says. How are these two things the same? How are they different? And they're spending time researching and looking at different angles, and they're learning research skills. They're learning history skills. They may be applying math depending on whether they're calculating, you know, how far he marched. This one says he marched so far. This one says he marched that far. Which one's more realistic? How close are they? And it's a project that they're working on. They're employing all these other skills and talents. They could do a first-person writing project. Imagine you're a tree there. There's trees at Gettysburg today. They're called witness trees, and you know they witnessed the battle. Imagine what it would have been like to be one of those witness trees with the bullets snapping your leaves off and the cannonballs whizzing by and shattering your buddies into firewood and all the rest, you know, and putting yourself into that mindset. And that's a practice they can do, a project they can all work on as an ongoing thing to apply the skills they're learning. And to me, that's kind of the equivalent of baking the bread for the company. You're actually taking the skills that you're learning and applying them to creating something useful or interesting for other people. I have another one. I won't go down all my items there, but I have a bunch of activities and things, lesson that you can do. So I put both of those links on there, and I also am in the process of starting an education blog with a lot of different ideas. It's not just education, but a lot of different ideas that I've been learning in grad school, so there'll be a link on that site for that too. So there's my shameless blog plug. So another thing is, equalize the workload. Use assessment to equalize the workload. Now we have this idea that fairness means everybody's doing the same amount of work. And actually fairness means everybody's doing the same amount of effort. Let's imagine that I was a gym instructor. We're going to practice lifting weights. So as you all come in, I'm like, okay, today everybody's going to lift 1,000 pounds of weights. Well, some of you can lift 100 pounds. So you walk over and lift 100-pound weight, wham, 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 10 times and you're done. So now you're just kind of twittering around in the back of the room. Over here, somebody, they haven't worked out that much, man. 10 pounds is all they can do. They got to lift that 10-pound weight 100 times, you know? And they're watching everybody else doing the other thing, and they're sweating it out, and everybody else is like, oh, you know, they're done. Assessment, formative assessment, is everybody is saying, all right, here I have 10-pound weights, 50-pound weights, 100-pound weights. I want you guys to come over here, and we're going to see what you can do. And I assess you as you're lifting weights. I say, wow, you look like 10 pounds about what you can handle. I want you to do 100 reps with 10 pounds. Oh, wow, you can lift 100 pounds. I want you to do 100 reps with 100 pounds. Y'all, you're 50. You're right in the middle. I want you to do 100 reps with 50. Everybody's going to be equally sweaty by the time the class is done because I've identified what their level of capability is rather than simply saying, here's your quota of stuff to do. Now go do it. And everybody is also going to develop their strength at about an equal rate. That's what assessment can help us do. It can help us to differentiate the workload or to diversify the workload to match where the students are at. And the other thing is you start doing that, and you also have where everybody's probably finishing about the same time. So you don't have some people that are sitting there twiddling around waiting for everybody else to get done because they're lifting more weight. And is that fair? Absolutely. It's absolutely fair because everybody's putting in the same amount of effort. I mean, that seems very rational. So you can do that. Group your students, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Group your students into those three groups. The introductory group, that's the one at the back. The average group, that's the one in the middle. The advanced group, that's the one. And this is not hard cut. Cut and dried. Hard and fast. You know, you're not going to say, okay, first week of school, you're going to do this assessment. Ugh, looks like you're in a back group. Oh, you guys are in the middle group. Yep, you're in the front group. And for the rest of the year, that's the groups they're in. Different people have different skill distributions. So you're going to move people back and forth. This is kind of an idea that you can use to know how much work you want to do with this group. So you know you have the group that's at the introductory level. They're needing some more help. So you're going to give them some extra help. Over here is the advanced group. They've already gotten the concept, so you're going to figure out some extensions they can do. Now, for example, you're studying square footage. How do you calculate square footage? So, you know, this group is really having a hard time, so you're doing all the little diagrams and graph paper and all those good things to try to show them to understand it. Okay, these fellows already understood it the first time you said length times width. They're like, oh, of course, because it's so many long, so many, and you're just multiplying them. It's the same as it's basically a number chart if you think about it. And you're like, great. Now, what I want you to do is go and look in the Bible and find where God tells Noah about building the ark and find out how big the ark is and convert those measurements into modern measurements and then tell me how many square feet of storage space Noah had on the ark considering he had three decks. Okay, now they're taking their skill and they're applying it. You know, and then you could say now, think if you can find a building or tell me how big a building would be to have the same amount of storage space or square footage on one floor as the ark had on three floors. So once again, they're having to take that knowledge and they're having to apply it. So that's what the advanced group is doing. The average group, you know, they're somewhere in the middle. They may actually learn it before the first group does. And so you're going to tell them to go and help figure out the ARC, or you're going to give them another project to do. So where they're applying the information. So this is kind of a way you can differentiate between the groups. Well, maybe the next group, somebody who was in the introductory group is in the advanced group because fractions just click for them and fractions are hard for everybody else. So, you know, you're going to be continually moving them around. And to figure out what people need, a good exercise, one good formative assessment, and I use this for some of you who have been in my classes, KWL, knowledge, what do I already know? What do I want to learn? And what have I learned? Once they're finished, they can fill this in. So the W column is really nice because it actually helps them to guide their learning. They're looking for the information they're trying to learn as they're going through the material. So And yeah, I've somehow gotten a little bit behind there. So then continue to assess skill levels. This needs to be the pulse of your classroom. Continually assessing. At least a couple times a week, you know, that you're checking. Where are they at? Are they learning this? Are they able to do this? Can they demonstrate what they know? How is this going for them? And then continually then going and applying what they're learning in some type of real life scenario. You know, if you're talking about, you know, maybe multiplication or something like that, you might do something like, hey, you're going to plan a canoe trip. There's going to be 25 people on a canoe trip, okay? And you're going to need to pack enough beans for them to eat. You're going to need to pack enough, you know, because a lot of that we're going to want milk for our cereal in the morning. So we're going to have an ice chest. So how many ice chests, how many square cubic feet of ice are we going to need? What's the cubic volume of a milk jug? How much milk is everybody going to drink in the morning? Plan all this out. You know, and then they have to start actually applying this. Wow, you know. Okay, so if there's 20 people, and those 20 people are each going to eat, you know, a bowl of Wheaties, and there's 10 bowls of Wheaties per box, we're going to need so many bowls of Wheaties, so many boxes of Wheaties in our thing, you know. Oh, actually, we're going to need, you know, we're going to need a container vessel because this canoe's just not going to cut it, or whatever, you know. So they're going to start calculating. And then what you can do is they can actually look and see, is my math making sense? Because one of them goes and multiplies something, or they divide instead of multiplying, or what's even funnier is when they multiply instead of dividing, and they say, we need 14,000 jugs of milk. You're like, no, wait a minute. Does that actually make sense? Think about that. Do you have any idea how much milk that is? I mean, these are living story problems. And the reason people have problems with story problems is because they're not actually thinking through what the story problem shows. So these are ways that you can take and then apply them, and this is way better than busy work. And this is a project you're working on. So give them something like that and then say, go to work on this, you know. Design this. Think about this. How many canoes would we need to take the whole class on a two-week trip? I don't know. We could figure it out. We could absolutely figure it out. You know, how many canoes would we need just for the supplies to take these people on a trip? You know, if a canoe can hold. So then they might have to do some research. Go and see how many pounds can a canoe hold? How much does a can of beans weigh? And these are all real-life things that they're going to use as skills one day. And then they ask you, when am I going to use this in life? And you say, I don't know. Maybe one day you'll plan a canoe trip and you'll need to know how many cans of milk to take along or something like that. So this is a way to apply what you're doing. And then you can continue to assess. So when they tell you they need 1,400 gallons of milk, that tells you something's wrong in their thought process. You know, they either don't understand how much milk that truly is, or they're thinking, okay, we only have 15 people here. I mean, how much is each person going to drink? You know, that's a lot of milk. So continue to assess. So here's a sample 5-day plan. And I'm going to explain, and once again, I want to stress, I'm not saying everybody run home and do exactly this. This is an idea to help you understand how this, all these ideas and all these practices could work in shoe leather. The reason I like the 5-day plan, there's three reasons. Number one, because we have 5-day weeks at school, so you have a nice discrete chunk. Number two, if you use CLE, their books are already divided into 5-day plans. And number three, 5 days is enough time for you to take a skill from conceptual to completion. You have enough time to weave, review into that. In a lot of public schools, they have their state standards they go by. Well, one of the public schools I did my field work at, each class chooses one standard per week that they're working on. So what are we working on this week? We're learning this week. We're learning this skill this week. So how does this work? Well, first of all, you have a multidisciplinary project you've chosen. Okay? So we'll use the example of the canoe trip. So here's a canoe trip that we're going to go on. Okay? So that's what you're going to do. You guys are going to be planning a canoe trip. Maybe you over here are going to be planning something different. You're going to be designing this thing. You might have the students, you might have a menu of 5 options, and the students get to choose which project do you want to work on. So this is going to be a major component, so you want to have that prepared when you start this 5-day plan. So then you choose a specific skill, and specific skill actually means specific skill, okay? You're not going to say, well, this week we're going to learn about fractions. That's not specific, because they're not going to learn everything there is to know about fractions in 1 week.
We're going to learn about adding fractions together that have a common denominator, or adding fractions together that don't have a common denominator, or, you know, whatever it is. Or we're just going to get an introduction to even understanding what fractions are. Why do we use fractions? What are they? And then once you start understanding that, you start building on it. And your curriculum is going to give you your sequence. So you're going to look at your curriculum. Your curriculum is going to say, first week, you're going to learn about this thing. Second week, you're going to learn about this thing. So use that as a guide. Feel free to use that as a guide. That's great. So they say, we're going to learn about this week one. So you say, good, let's learn about that on week one. And most curricula do not learn more than about one or two skills a week. So that's something that is that's pretty common, you know. And sure, they have five lessons. They have four lessons and a quiz if you're using CLE. But the thing is, the first lesson introduces something, then the others are refining it or showing different angles of the same concept. So you can kind of lump that as one concept you're working on as the week progresses. So these are your prerequisites. So you choose a skill, usually from your curriculum. You list the steps it takes to reach that skill. You identify ways to extend the skill into real-life practices or show them how it links to their multidisciplinary project they're working on. And then you're assessing their prior knowledge. You've already done that before you start. And I'll tell you a good time to do that later. So on day one, you teach the basic idea. Okay, what's going on here? What are we learning? Today we're learning about adding fractions together. We've already done it where they have the same denominator, but what happens if they have a different denominator? Can we do? Now remember, we never add the bottom, right? Oh yes, absolutely. And they already know that, you know. So you start teaching. So here's what we have to do, and here's why we have to do it. And you're assessing student understanding. Are they getting this? Do they know it? Can they demonstrate it? And then you maybe write some problems on the board, and you have students do it. And once that student can consistently do it, you say, okay, obviously you have it. You push them. You see if you can rattle them or cause them to doubt. Oh, no, you can do it. Or maybe you have worksheets you give them. If you can get 9 out of 10 of these right, working independently, you obviously know the skill. As soon as a student can demonstrate to you that they actually have an understanding of this, you say, great, you have your multidisciplinary project we've talked about that you've been working on the last couple weeks. Go work on that now. You can go work on your project. So you're continually cycling out the students from the class session that already understand it. So you're not belaboring the point to them. So then day two, you're still going to have students that don't understand it. You're going to reteach. You're going to explain in new ways. You've already done some assessments, so you understand, oh, this is his weak point. That's why he's not getting it. That's why it's not clicking. You review. You make sure that the students that got it yesterday still have it, can still demonstrate they know it. You give them the pushback and so on. And so as they once again demonstrate they know it, you cycle them off to the project as they demonstrate mastery. So the size of students, the size of the group of students you're working with is going to be shrinking as time goes on, as they're demonstrating mastery. Day three, once again, you require them to demonstrate mastery. And what I would probably do in this case is have a worksheet prepared. And I'd hand out the worksheet and say, okay, now it's time for math. We're at day three. You are going to add these concepts. You're going to show me you can do this. You're going to do this worksheet. You get 9 out of 10 correct. Working independently, that means I'm not here to walk you through the steps. That means I'm not here to tell you. You do it. Let me see what you have. Once you can do that, then you go work on your project. The rest of us, we're going to go into a small group, and I'm really going to start trying to identify what is it that he doesn't get. Where's the missing link? Where's that switch that needs to flip to make the lights come on that, wow, we actually understand this? So then, in day four, we continue to develop proficiency. And here's maybe where you've had enough time to deal with it. You might do some speed drills with it, or you might do some games or something to get them on their toes and get them really fast at it. So that you have continual review that's going on here. And you're making sure they can actually independently use this. And then you have small group intervention for the ones that still are not getting it. And so you're targeting any remaining weaknesses. You're identifying, trying to isolate where the problem is. And day five, you have, this should actually be summative, I have formal, which formal assessment is like giving a quiz, so that part is also true. But summative assessment means it's the final assessment to show or demonstrate, yes, this was actually learned. And once again, if you're using, for instance, CLE, that's actually built into the curriculum. They've got a quiz there, and they can do the quiz, and that demonstrates they have learned the skill. Now, you may need to, in future weeks, you may have one or two people that are not able to do the summative assessment at the level that shows that they know it. So you may have to be working on that in the small group interventions as well to bring them up to where they need to be. But most of your students are going to be at the level they need to be. And then after you've done the formal summative assessment, then you can offer another formative assessment to set you up for next week so that you know where the students are, where the knowledge level is, and so on, and you continue it that way. So like I said, this method here is not the only way to do it, but it's a way that you can see how these ideas could work in the classroom. So I recommend to you once again, you know, take the ideas that you can use now and take them into your classroom. But most of all, change your mindset. Change the way you think about doing school, about what education is, about learning skills. And I highly recommend, try to bring in some of these long-term projects that you can do to help the students. And the thing is, I kind of have three categories, and I think I may have put them on your worksheet. But there's making stuff, there's writing stuff, and then there's like artistic stuff. So I have on your handout some different ideas of some ways you could do that. You know, if you were doing a unit in history about the Revolutionary War, then you could apply some of the other skills, some of the other classes, like using fractions for a recipe or maps and those kind of things to figure that out. All right, well, thank you so much for your attention. And if you have any questions you'd like to talk to me afterward, I'd be glad to answer anything. You're dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.